Welcome back to Coach Class with me, Dom Birch. This is the podcast where we get to speak to inspirational leaders and coaches from across the world. And I'm absolutely delighted this week to welcome one of Bradford and Leeds's finest, Dr. Bob Gomersall. Now, Bob founded Surpass Assessment, which is part of the BTL group, back in 1985. He's currently the chair. He was educated at the universities of Durham and Bristol and worked as a theoretical physicist at the Max Planck Institute in Stuttgart. He also taught physics at Manchester Grammar School and Bradford Grammar School, where he was head of physics. And he is the chair and founder of Advanced Digital Innovations. Listen, Bob, I'm going to stop there, because if I keep on going with your CV, we'll have no time to chat. But welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dom. Nice to be here.
Now, we know each other through Bradford Breakthrough, which is another thing that you do. But before we get into all of that, and before we get into the book that you've just written, which is the real reason that you're here, right? We're going to talk about Worthwhile Wealth, which is the entrepreneur's guide to success that satisfies. But we'll come on to that in a moment. Let's just reverse back a little bit. So, educated at Leeds Grammar School, just tell us about your journey. How did you end up in physics? How did you end up becoming an entrepreneur? What's your story, Bob?
Well, I didn't really plan it. I mean, it's sort of, in a way, it's all happened by accident, or at least that's not quite true, actually. The key points in my life when I've made major decisions to jump out of the tram lines that I was in, and perhaps I'll talk a bit about that. But, my first love at school was, especially when I got into the sixth form, was physics. I really enjoyed it. I found I was pretty good at it. And I really just wanted to get to the bottom of understanding that kind of thing. So I went to university to do physics, and theoretical physics is fascinating, very difficult, but I like the challenge of it, really. And so I was keen to get into research, doing that sort of thing. I found that I was reasonably good at research, enjoyed it very much. And for a while, it looked like that was going to be where my career went, really, going into academia, possibly becoming a professor or something. And that was kind of the first stage in my career, where there came a point really where the realization that I would have to go and live anywhere in the world and follow where that took me. And that just conflicted with my love of the outdoors and being able to go into the hills and the mountains and so on. And so at some point I thought, well, I'm going to have to compromise on this. And so I decided to jump out of that. And it was a big decision, actually, very difficult. And things were going very well. At that point, I decided to try my hand teaching physics, a very significant change, really.
As you think back to those teaching days, Bob, what are the kind of things that changed, or what did you learn about teaching? Because there must be something magical about working with young people, particularly young, bright people who really want to learn and want to, you know, really cut their teeth at something like physics.
Yes, I was very lucky, really, in the sense that I loved doing physics research. I jumped out of it and didn't know where to go, but I found that I really like working with youngsters, and especially teenagers. I mean, a lot of teachers don't like teenagers, surprisingly, really. Actually, a lot of teachers don't like children, I've found out. But I really did like working with teenagers, especially sort of 14, 15-year-olds. I still miss that, actually. I mean, that was an aspect. There's aspects of every job that you miss, and that's the one I miss of teaching. And in particular, I mean, physics is seen as a difficult subject, but when you really do it carefully and make sure all the steps are clear, it's remarkable how many youngsters really can get to grips with it and really understand it and get to be enthusiastic about it. So, yes, it, as you suggested, it's really working with young people, that was a great part of the job. That's what I loved about it.
And then how did you sort of pivot then from there into deciding to set up your own businesses, and not just sort of any old businesses, but really, like, you know, when you think back 20, 30 years ago, digital training, online, you know, all these health and education, you know, which now you almost take for granted. But I would imagine when you were coming up with these ideas were pretty out there.
The thing about teaching is, there's not got that creative element that research has, and so I was always looking for ways to sort of bring that together. And very early on, I was pretty keen on using computers, and actually before the desktop computer appeared at Manchester Grammar, they bought one of the first minis that appeared in schools. Very few schools had anything, but had a mini there. And I was able to set tests on that mini and tell the sixth formers to go off and do the tests in the lunchtime or something, and it would mark them automatically and give them the answers. And actually, that is pretty much what Surpass Assessment still does, on obviously on a much bigger scale. That was my first sort of idea. It went nowhere. I realised, I thought it was going to be quite a big opportunity when the desktop computers appeared, but it didn't go anywhere. I tried talking to awarding bodies and so on, got nowhere at all. So that sort of went on a shelf, which actually is pretty typical of the sort of things I get involved in. Innovations often do go on a shelf, and then we take them off the shelf later on. And the next thing that happened was I had to teach some electronics. So I had to learn about electronics. It was evolving rapidly, and as a physics teacher, you needed to know something about electronics. And so I set myself a project of making something, and I ended up, a doctor friend suggested I made an audiometer. And I thought, if I make it to a decent standard, then we could sell it. So I did, and I started, I made one. And we started selling it, and I got my dad to assemble it, and my mum to do the packaging and the marketing, off it went. Really, that was the first thing that began to make money. It was on the side, and I did it on the side for quite a long time. There was a little bit of friction at work, but overall, I think my colleagues and the headmaster David Smith were very supportive, actually, and I'm very grateful to them for that.
What are those ingredients that, you know, you'll be self-deprecating and perhaps not even think of them as being particularly special, but those ingredients that are inside somebody that is entrepreneurial, you know, and there has to be sort of a blend of curiosity, a bit of, I don't know, just that sort of sense of, I'm going to do this regardless, but also sometimes that kind of blind madness at the start, where if you had any idea how hard it was going to be, you might not get going in the first place.
Well, I'm not sure it's quite like that. I do think almost every kid has got it in them. I mean, you just need to watch. It's an ice cream van nearby. You watch the average child in the negotiating with their parent, and they will dream up 20 reasons why they want, a 99 chocolate flake in the cone and so on. And they're just constantly at it. And so I think, in a way, actually, I think that the education system drums it out of people. So I don't think it's that unique, actually. I think it's the hard part is getting to where you can reinstate it and do something with it. And that certainly, I found that quite hard. And I think the other thing is, we're all used to a lot of stability in our lives. And one of the things about setting up a business is suddenly it all looks a bit fragile and a bit volatile and a bit uncomfortable. And so that's something that we've got to kind of get used to. But I do believe most people are creative enough to do it if they have to.
And let's talk then a little bit about your book, right? So you've written this book, Worthwhile Wealth, and it's described as a guide that redefines how success and wealth are measured. And obviously you're drawing down on lots of your own experiences to give people advice on how to start a business, how to grow a business.
Yeah.
And talking about it being profitable but fulfilling, and this sort of understanding what it is that really drives people and where they get that sense of satisfaction and energy from. And purpose, I guess, because, I mean, you know, you have to have some sense of real purpose that drives you forward, because it can't always just be about building a thing or a thing being financially successful. And those things, ingredients are important, obviously. But what was it, as you were writing the book, what was it that you were reflecting on over your sort of, I guess, your serial life of building and creating successful things?
At the starting point, I've worked with a lot of entrepreneurs one way or another. And what they've all got in common, in my experience, is they're not driven by money. It's a sort of convention in society, yes, that entrepreneurs are money is what they're after. But I think that's more like a measure of performance, really. And much more, when you start a business, especially, that you're thinking about, well, what, you know, you've got an idea or you'd like to do something, or I'd like to see it succeed, or if you think it's worthwhile, maybe worthwhile to you as an individual, it's something you like doing, or maybe it's worthwhile to society and you want society to benefit from it and maybe get some kudos or some other benefit from it, or just the approval, appreciation of your personal contacts. I don't know, all sorts of things like that. But very few actually are sustained long-term by money. And I know quite a few who've made money and say, well, I've made my money now. I didn't like what I was doing, but I did it. And now I don't, and I can do what I want. But actually, I don't know what I want to do. And that is surprisingly common. It's sort of the purpose in life has been just to get this business grown, but then they're not clear what they want to do with it or what they really want out of life. And so part of it is much better to think early on what you want to do. And starting a business is one of the ways to do it. It's not the only way, of course. I mean, there are lots of people in, say, medicine or indeed even occasionally in accountancy who actually love what they're doing and are very happy doing it. That's fine if you can solve it that way. But for a lot of people, creating a business is an opportunity to create it in a way that allows you to live the life that you want to live. I mean, I think, you know, in the old days, if you're an aristocrat, you could do what you wanted to do all the time. Well, if you organise your life so you're doing what you want to do anyway, then you've got all the benefits of being an aristocrat without having to find the money from anywhere.
I like that notion. Yeah, I like that notion. I mean, it's fun. It's really interesting to me. I think I was very lucky in life that in my mid-30s, I had a career break from Asda. So I went from, you know, being in a really quite challenging, stressful environment that I've been in for a while, and actually taking time to sort of get off the treadmill actually and reevaluate what is important in life and where does work fit alongside family and, you know, all those other things. And it was like, it was a bit like I sort of described it at the time as having a midlife crisis without the crisis. It was kind of like the midlife reflection where you go, hang on a minute, what is it that I really am inspired to do? Where do I get that sense of fulfillment? And therefore, how does work sit around that or be part of it, or rather than just the only thing that I do that, you know, gobbles up all of my time and energy? Some people you notice don't get to that point until later in life. And I guess this book is a bit of a guide to say, you know, stop and think early rather than let life happen to you, being a little bit more of control of your destiny.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that, unfortunately, the education system does tend to put you in tramlines. I mean, if you go to school and you're good at something, and then you maybe go to university or into an apprenticeship and you're good at that, then that kind of just seems a natural way to do it. And then at some point, you may find that actually I don't like what I'm doing. And I came across this quite a lot walking in the mountains. People seem to open up when they're in the mountains and they'll tell you all sorts of things that they wouldn't do just every day. I used to lead, well, I still do lead a lot of walkers in the mountains, and you hear all sorts, and you often hear people say, I hate my job. And you say, well, what is it about it? Is it, oh, they tell you and so on. But, well, why don't you do something about it? And your point about this sort of a midlife change, some people take a grip and do something about it. But often the constraints are reasonably well-defined. Money, obviously, is one of them. Status is another one. I can remember talking to a barrister who said he hated his job. That's a lady. She hated her job. What's stopping you doing it? Is it money? No. Is it status? Well, pause, you know, and you realize it is. It's the status. And going back to square one, which effectively I've done twice, it's quite hard. You know, you sort of suddenly think, I'm going back to square one. Do I really want to do it? But what I did discover is that loss of status, or worrying about loss of status, lasts about half an hour, really. And it's not such a big deal at all.
That's really interesting. I remember talking to somebody who had a very senior job and lost that job actually, and was worrying and anxious about how others were judging them, whether or not people were, you know, looking down on them or were, you know, and they were almost, their actions then were driven by this sort of slight anxiety that other people were sat around, you know, all really bated breath to see what would happen next. And I just said to them, is that true? That those people you're imagining are thinking that. And they sort of just stopped and we were walking along the canal and they went, probably not. I said, okay, well, if you know that the opposite's true and they're not really waiting to see what you're going to do next, what would you do differently? And it was just like this light bulb moment of going, well, I'll just get on and do the next thing. Right, okay. Well, and off they went.
And the key point is your friends don't give a damn. I mean, your friends aren't that interested. I mean, you know, your friends aren't that interested in some fancy point of physics that you've just unearthed for the first time, or indeed how many people you employ. I mean, what I found very interesting is that my friends are much more interested in this book that I've written than in anything else I've done. And so that in itself brings out the point. Your friends are friends. They just, you know, they know you and like you for other things, I hope, rather than what you do in your work life.
What did you learn as you wrote the book? And I'm always interested in how different creative people do the things they do, whether it's artists or musicians. Or did you just sit down, you know, at the typewriter or at the computer or with a pen? Did you just start writing, or was it quite a formulaic thing? Was it something that's been, I don't know, actually percolating over many years and you just had to bring all the post-it notes together? What was your process?
Well, I've been thinking about it for a long time, and I've got lots of ideas along the lines of this book, although but I knew I didn't have time to do it properly. I mean, and also I think I'm a bit of a stodgy writer, actually. So I spent quite a bit of time trying to find a ghostwriter to work with me on it. That was a difficult job, actually. And then I heard a lady on, called Shannon Kyle, actually, on the radio. And I just thought, yeah, she sounds good. So I got in touch with her, and effectively worked together. She started by trying to create a writing style which I was comfortable with, which, you know, she thought reflected my own way of talking and doing things. And then I just spent hours and hours and hours talking to her, hours and hours to sort of writing down bullet points and things that I wanted to say. And she put it into writing. It's fantastic. I mean, the results, I was really pleased we did it all in 6 months. So I found that, you know, a very good and useful experience, really, and very enjoyable. The other thing about working with a ghostwriter was that she's very motivational. You know, when you're getting cheesed off or tired, she comes on the line, you know, with the teams and cheerful and bright and breezy, and off we go again. And actually, I had a lot of support from my colleague Sally Abbott as well, who's works with me on all my business activities. And she helped pull things together and so on. So it's been a bit of a team effort, really. And I, you know, I think that has helped no end. I don't think I could have done it, given that when I started, I was still chairman of a couple of businesses and had quite a lot of other things going on as well. So, well, what I've learned is it's possible to do it efficiently, and that's what we managed to do.
And did you learn anything new or relearn? Because I sometimes find in life that it's a bit like when you read a book that you've read before and you kind of go, gosh, yeah, I've forgotten all about that. I'd kind of somewhere there in the back of my mind, but it wasn't at the forefront of mine. Were there certain things or themes that emerged that you just thought, gosh, that's so true? Did you relearn things as you were going through the process?
Well, one thing that does occur to me that we learned was this concept of flourishing or thriving is quite a topical thing at the moment. A lot of people are writing about it. You know, you get a lot of people writing about business, talking about it, people, academics, a lot of it, and about this whole area. And I suppose my sort of edge, if you like, in this is that I'm coming at it from an entrepreneurial point of view rather than the point of view of an employee or an economist or an academic. So that was one realization. I think another one was that if you start, economists always talk about the economy from a top-down approach, but actually a lot of change comes from bottom-up, entrepreneurs doing things and making things happen. I'm slightly embarrassed that I quote Elon Musk in there because he's talked such bloody nonsense some of the time, but one of the things about him was he started from scratch in the electric car industry, Tesla. And that's a remarkable thing because it wasn't the existing car manufacturers that moved electric cars forward. It was somebody starting from scratch and building it up. And I think that's quite important in all sorts of areas. And there's a piece in the book about eco-entrepreneurs, and I think the ecological problems we have and the problems in the environment, a big part of the solution is going to be people starting business or developing businesses that address some of the key problems we've got there. So I think I learned that one as well.
And I hear you at Bradford Breakthrough often make the point when we're talking about education, or we might be talking about homelessness, or we're talking about, I don't know, the city of culture, which is coming to Bradford and we're all very, very proud and excited by. I hear you use this phrase that if you gave that problem to this group of people around the table, we'd come up with five solutions in 10 minutes, you know, because because that's the way that everyone's wired, isn't it? You have to. You're constantly having to overcome hurdles. And if, you know, if a barrier comes along or you're constrained in some way, it's kind of like, well, okay, well, that's a constraint. Right, what are we going to do about it then?
Well, certainly. I mean, that's, I always think if you get a group of business people and entrepreneurs together and present a problem, they're all like little wind-up action men. They all sit there and start thinking how they would solve the problem. I was really struck years ago when Airedale Hospital decided they were going to share their problems really with local businesses. And they told us all the different issues that they had. And the room was just full of business people trying to come up with ideas and solutions to their problems. In fact, one of the problems that came up was that of the fact that a lot of their patients are distributed over a wide area. And so we came... Advanced Digital Institute came up with the idea of doing remote consultations. This was long before Teams and Zoom and so on. And we actually started doing it. And I don't really know where that went in the end, but it, certainly for a period of time, we were helping them to do remote consultations on screen. And that obviously saved a lot of time, saved lots of people having to travel into the hospital for a consultation. Hopefully it was more efficient for them. I imagine that's moved on dramatically, although I've lost touch with it since.
Well, I can tell you it has, because I know that my mother-in-law, who lives in Saltaire in the apartments down there, has Airedale virtual clinics, virtual wards come
really?
To the house. Yeah.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. That's great. Actually, well, that's really interesting, because you lose touch, you know, you generate ideas and innovations through one of the businesses. And then, for one reason or another, you lose touch with it. As soon as you're not directly involved, things happen, and, you know, it's actually lovely to hear that it's continued and it's been successful, really.
Yeah, absolutely revolutionising how people interact with healthcare rather than having to go to a hospital, which, for, you know, is never a pleasant experience. Bob, what's round the corner? What can you see coming that you think is changing how businesses operate, or frankly, what is it that still motivates and drives you? You know, I imagine there are no plans to slow down or stop. And, you know, we haven't even talked about what you do up in the Lake District and all those other things that you also involve yourself in half the time. So what's round the corner for Mr. Bob Gomersall?
Oh, well, for us and for our business, we're very interested in personalised learning. I mean, actually, I've been interested in that right from the beginning. That's what drove me. I thought technology has the potential to do what private tutors do. And I thought it would all happen, you know. By 1990, I thought it would all be happening. Well, we're still here and it's still not happening. But it's, I think we're in a position with, particularly with things like AI coming along, artificial intelligence, I think there are some new opportunities to really move that one on. It's a very difficult problem. And it's very multidimensional, involves education, technology, and so on. But it's something I'm really keen on, and so I'm, with my colleagues, we're now looking at hard about what we can do about it. So I think that's important. That's part of the wider artificial intelligence thing, which is obviously potentially having a significant impact in a lot of areas of business. So, you know, I'm interested in that, but really, I'm just interested in, it's not the technology itself, what you can do with it. As far as business in general is concerned, well, the biggest observation is this, that 200 years ago, everybody worked from home. And during the Industrial Revolution, we moved towards a situation where more and more people had to go and be controlled by their employer in their place of work. and we're just reverting. You can see it right across the economy, slowly reverting back to people at least partially working from home again, which is probably a jolly good thing, really. It's not possible for everybody, but it is, I think, given that less than 10% of the economy is manufacturing, where you have to work from a central location, more and more working from home will become the norm, and it has for us, really.
It's always fascinating catching up with you, Bob. I want to ask you one last question. And we're both here in Bradford. We go to Bradford Breakthrough. We're looking forward to City yeah. Culture. What is it that, you know, it's like I always think that Bradford's one of those sort of little secrets that we know how fantastic and wonderful and dynamic and, you know, vibrant it is as a place, but loads of other people don't know. And it's kind of like I'm a bit sort of, you know, I'm in two minds. I don't want too many people to find out, but at the same time, we want to share in our wonderfulness. So what is it that you're looking forward to? Because we've got Bradford 25 coming next year, and it's a real moment of celebration and an opportunity to really put us on a pedestal, isn't it?
Well, it is indeed. And I mean, I think I'm really keen on what we can do on the entrepreneurial side, really. Encourage more Bradford people to set up a business or to create an enterprise of one sort or another. And I'm hoping part of them, the book would have some influence on that. But I am talking with lots of local business people as well about what we can do there. Looks to me like a bit of a gap, really, in the whole area of bringing entrepreneurs together to learn from each other and move the economy on. Lots of young people in Bradford, as you know, and young people are very keen, actually, from what I've made out. They're much keener to get into entrepreneurial activity than most of their predecessors. So there's a big opportunity there. And there's a big opportunity for them to get involved in the environmental issue as well. And a lot of young people are keen on that. So all that, I think, could happen really much more quickly in Bradford than anywhere else because of its relatively youthful population.
Well, listen, for the time being, Bob, thank you so much. And for our avid listeners, Worthwhile Wealth, an Entrepreneur's Guide to Success That Satisfies, is out now, and you can find it in all the usual places.
Yes, it's out today, actually.
It is out today. And if I can get this edited in time, that will still be today. Bob, for the time being, thank you so much. Look forward to seeing you at the next Bradford Breakthrough meeting, 7:30 in the morning, I know. Always an early start, but always good fun.
Okay, Dom.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Bob.
See you now.
You've been listening to Coach Class with me, Dom Birch. If you'd like to find out more, you can go to LinkedIn or you can go to coachclass.buzzsprout.com.